Good morning. It's 9:15. I think we'll start the Journal Club. This is Carol Farber from the University of Michigan. Who else is on the line?
This is Lawrence.
Okay, so we have a couple others. Good. So we have four articles for discussion. This is the March 2020 Journal Club looking at the February 2020 articles. This is my inaugural Journal Club. It's exciting to be here. We're going to start off with the discussion articles, and Dr. Lauren Frisky, who's our thoracic fellow at the University of Michigan, will start off that discussion. So take it away, Lawrence.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Farber. Good morning, everyone. The first article for discussion this morning is entitled The Role of Histologic Grading and Ki-67 Index in Predicting Outcomes in Pulmonary Carcinoid Tumors. It was authored in part by Dr. Farber, as well as one of her colleagues at the Cleveland Clinic. As we know, pulmonary carcinoid tumors are currently staged using the same AACC-TNM staging system in the eighth edition that we use for all lung malignancies. So when it comes to staging carcinoid tumors, we consider things like tumor size, extent of involvement, and nodal status. But one thing that we don't currently consider is histologic type. In other words, whether we're dealing with a typical or an atypical carcinoid. That being said, we all obviously recognize that histologic type is a very strong predictor of long-term prognosis. Obviously, atypical carcinoids have a worse prognosis and a higher risk of recurrence. In addition, unlike for gastrointestinal and pancreatic neuroendocrine neoplasms, the current WHO definitions for pulmonary carcinoid tumors do not consider Ki-67 labeling index. Currently, the distinction between typical and atypical carcinoid obviously is based primarily on mitotic counts. So the purpose of this study was basically twofold. Number one, to examine the correlation between histologic type, Ki-67 proliferation index, morphologic pattern, and lymphovascular invasion status in carcinoid tumors with respect to outcomes in terms of tumor recurrence. And second, to propose a modified staging system to better risk stratify carcinoid tumors. So the authors of this study reviewed all surgical lung resection cases that had a primary diagnosis of carcinoid tumor at a single large institution between 1995 and 2016. The authors only included typical carcinoids and atypical carcinoid tumors. Large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas and small cell carcinomas were not included in the study. For each case, the authors collected the following information: nodal status, histologic type, mitotic count, major morphologic pattern, recurrence, and overall survival. If you like, you can turn to page 228 in the article. Figure 2 is a nice figure that basically highlights the major morphologic patterns that the authors observed. They're the typical patterns that we see in carcinoid tumors, but it's a nice little figure. Exclusionary criteria for this study were the following. Any patient that, in addition to carcinoid tumor, had a diagnosis of another malignancy, cases where the resection of the carcinoid tumor had a positive margin, cases that didn't have at least a minimum of 3 months follow-up with a repeat chest CT to look for recurrence, and also cases that did not have complete staging data. For each case, the authors selected a paraffin block that had high tumor content, and then they took the tissue and stained it with an antibody for Ki-67. The subsequent stain slides were then digitalized at maximum resolution using a perioscan scope. For each scan slide, at least 4 hotspots were manually selected. These were areas that had the highest number of Ki-67 positive staining. The Ki-67 proliferation index was then calculated using a computer-assisted digital algorithm that factored into account things such as percent positive nuclei, staining intensity, et cetera. A minimum of 1,000 nuclei were analyzed for each slide, and there was an average of 22,000 nuclei per case. If you're interested in visualizing how this looked, figure one on page 226 in the article provides a nice summary of this method. So the authors identified 176 pulmonary carcinoid tumors. Table one on page 227 highlights the demographics. Basically, these included 165 typical carcinoids and only 11 atypical carcinoids. 13 cases experienced a recurrence, and these were comprised of 8 typical carcinoids and 5 atypical carcinoids. Only 4 patients, so 2% of cases, died of disease. Now, the results are highlighted in Table 2 on page 227. Basically, for mean Ki-67 index, it was significantly higher in atypical carcinoids compared to typical carcinoids. It also increased in higher stage disease and was higher in tumors that recurred compared to those that did not recur. There were no significant differences for mean Ki-67 index with respect to morphologic pattern. Tables 3 and 4 highlight the fact that for all carcinoids and for typical carcinoids alone, only Ki-67 index was a significant predictor of recurrence on the multivariate analysis, not morphologic pattern or lymphovascular invasion status. If you turn to figure 3 on page 229, you'll see an ROC curve that the authors generated. This ROC curve showed that for typical carcinoids, the optimal cutoff value for Ki-67 index to predict recurrence was 5%. This value on the curve represented the point at which there was a maximum difference between a true positive and a false positive. So then figure 4A has a Kaplan-Meier curve that shows that carcinoid tumors with a Ki-67 index greater than 5% were significantly more likely to recur than those that had a Ki-67 index of less than or equal to 5%. So based on all of these results, the authors took their cases and separated them into 3 tiers based on both histologic type and the Ki-67 index. So what that means is that typical carcinoids that had a Ki-67 index of less than or equal to 5% were designated grade 1. Typical carcinoids that had a Ki-67 index greater than 5% were designated grade 2. And atypical carcinoids, regardless of the Ki-67 index, were designated grade 3. Figure 4B on page 230 shows a Kaplan-Meier curve, which highlights that basically you have a significantly increased likelihood of recurrence with each incremental increase in grade based on this 3-tier grading scheme. So what the authors next did was propose a modified staging based on the current 8th edition of the AJCC. This gets a little bit difficult to verbalize, so I recommend following along in Table 5 on page 230. But basically, this is what the authors are proposing. For the grade 1 tumors, so typical carcinoids with a Ki of less than or equal to 5%, basically keep the staging the same as the current 8th edition of the AJCC. For grade 2 tumors, so that would be typical carcinoids with a Ki-67 index greater than 5%, the authors recommend upstaging all stage group 1 tumors to stage group 2A and all stage current stage 2A tumors to stage group 2B. Everything above that would stay the same. For the grade 3 tumors, so these are the atypical carcinoids, the authors recommend upstaging all group 1 and 2 tumors to stage group 3A and current 3A tumors to stage group 3B. Everything above that would stay the same. So maybe an oversimplified way of thinking about this would be basically grade 1 tumors equate with stage 1 disease, grade 2 tumors equate with at least stage 2 disease, and grade 3 tumors equate with at least stage 3 disease. Figure 5 on page 230 shows two Kaplan-Meier curves that show that this proposed staging system correlates very well with likelihood of tumor recurrence. And actually, it performs better than the current 8th edition of the AJCC. And the authors point out that in their cohort of tumors, three of the tumors that recurred, which were typical carcinoids, were originally classified as stage group 1A3. However, all three of these tumors had a Ki-67 index greater than 5%. So using the author's modified gradings and staging scheme, these tumors would have been classified as grade 2 and restaged as grade group 2A, which would have better predicted their recurrence. So what are the take-home messages? Well, I think the primary value of such a three-tier grading system is that it risk stratifies typical carcinoids, which account for more than 90% of all pulmonary carcinoids, into those cases with a low likelihood of recurrence and those with an increased or intermediate likelihood of recurrence. Second, this proposed modified staging system seems to correlate very well with risk of recurrence, and it's relatively easy for pathologists to implement. I think the one thing that poses a potential challenge is accurate calculation of Ki-67 indices. Obviously, manual counts are very tedious, and depending on the method that one uses, there's a propensity for considerable inter-observer variability. The way that the authors get around this in this study is they used whole slide image analysis for automated quantification, which is really nice, but the issue there would be not everybody, especially those out in the community, maybe have access to such digital platforms. If anyone has any questions or comments on this article, we can entertain those before moving on to the next article.
Yeah, I have a question about management. Is there a recommendation on management based on this staging?
I don't believe that there's any specific recommendation in terms of management other than how clinicians would manage stages, you know, 1, 2, and 3. I mean, basically, the management would be the same as for the current edition of the AJCC. It's just based on the stage, it's the staging that would change.
So what you develop is a prognostic marker rather than a management decision
exactly.
Maker.
Right. I think that's a
just to add a little bit to that, we're eager to expand this study too. It's a relatively small study of 170 some patients. So I think it needs more patients into it to confirm this staging, but we thought it was a nice first step around saying, look, there is a difference between typical carcinoids.
Well, certainly it's taken a while for us to be dragged into the Ki-67 arena, long behind the GI people.
Right. I don't know if that's good or bad, actually, but it does take a while. Any other questions?
This is Henry. Yeah, thanks. This is Henry. Question about have we, and this is, you know, my ignorance about other TNM staging in the new, you know, in the 8th edition. Have we in other organ systems, do we combine stage and grade to get a final stage? You know what I mean? So classically, stage is one thing, grade is another. So here we're mixing stage and grade to come up with a new stage. So my question is there precedent for that in the TNM system? There may well be. I just don't know about it. That's why I'm asking.
That's a great question. I'm not 100% sure about that. I know that the recent, obviously, gradings of the GI neuroendocrine neoplasms has changed significantly, but I don't know if there have been any recommendations in terms of their staging of those neoplasms. I'd have to look into that. But I'm not aware of any other precedent, actually. I don't know if Dr. Farber, if you are or not.
Yeah, I think that's right, too. I have this feeling that the GI people, the pancreatic people may use it, but I'm not sure it's been incorporated officially into a new staging system, so I don't know either.
Okay, thanks.
Anything else on that first paper? Thanks, Lauren. Excellent. So our second paper is one by Natasha Reckman and her group at Memorial Sloan Kettering. This is published in the Journal of Thoracic Oncology, and it's the SMARCA4 deficient thoracic sarcomatoid tumors represent primarily smoking-related undifferentiated carcinomas rather than a primary thoracic sarcoma. So the background of this is that there is this group of highly aggressive thoracic neoplasms that are characterized by a SMARCA4 deficiency, and this morphology that consists of a round cell and or a rhabdoid morphology. And these have been described, and they're proposed to be thoracic sarcomas. However, it's unclear whether these tumors might actually represent a sarcomatoid carcinoma. So the purpose of this study was to define the clinical, pathologic, immunohistochemical, and the genomic characteristics of these SMARCA4 deficient thoracic sarcomatoid tumors, the SDTSTs, as they call them, and compare them with the SMARCA4 deficient conventional non-small cell carcinomas that arise in the thorax, in an attempt to not only expand the definition of the clinical and pathologic features of these thoracic neoplasms, but also to try to define the nosologic relationship of these two sets, the non-small cells versus the sarcomatoid tumors that are SMARCA4 deficient. So it's a big study. There was a lot of heavy lifting in this. They took a retrospective review of the Memorial archives. They found 22 SMARCA deficient thoracic sarcomatoid tumors that were found in the archives. 9 of the cases were prospectively gathered during the year of 2016 and 2017. 8 cases were identified by a retrospective re-review of thoracic tumors from their NGS database. And then 5 cases were identified by a retrospective search of a pathology database that was just keyed for terms that included rhabdoid, nut, SMARCB1, INI1, BAF47. They came up with 22 what they would call sarcomatoid tumors with SMARCA4 deficiency. The criteria for using them in the study was they had to have undifferentiated round cell or rhabdoid morphology. They had to have the SMARCA4 loss by IHC, and they had the lack expression of claudin-4, which is a epithelial adhesion molecule. They then took 45 conventional lung non-small cell carcinomas that were predominantly adenocarcinomas and that also had SMARCA4 mutations or deficiencies, again, loss noted by immunohistochemistry that were found, again, in their BioPortal NGS database. So all of the tumors were analyzed for expression of SMARCA4, SMARCA2, claudin-4, SAL4, and CD34 as kind of stem cell markers. And then molecular and cytogenetic studies, 16 of the sarcomatoid tumors and all 45 of the non-small cell carcinomas were actually analyzed by an NGS platform that looked at somatic mutation, cancer genes, as well as tumor mutation burden. FISH for SMARCA4, the 19p13 locus was performed. So what were the results? The clinical pathologic characteristics of the SDTSTs, the sarcomatoid tumors, show that they were overwhelmingly male predominant, 73%. 21 of the 22 were smokers. Most were very heavy smokers. It had an interesting distribution of greater than 50-year-olds, but then there was a bump at 30 to 50 years of age as well. They were very large tumors. The primary tumor was anywhere from 2 to 18 centimeters. They were highly PET avid. 91% were stage 4 when diagnosed. The sites of metastases were lymph nodes, bone, and adrenal. Histologically, the sarcomatoid areas were mostly round cells with variable amounts of rhabdoid tumors. Keep in mind that 17 of the 22 specimens that they analyzed were analyzed on core biopsies. And then 5 of the 22 had a conventional non-small cell focus. The amount of it wasn't designated, but there was at least one non-small cell focus in 5 of these 22 sarcomatoid tumors. Looking at the IHC of these, 22 had a complete loss of SMARCA4, and 18 of the 22 had a complete loss of SMARCA2. They were positive for synaptophysin. There was a patchy diffuse positivity of EMA. And then 20 to 30% of them showed some positivity of SAL4 and CD34. They were completely negative for claudin-4, cytokeratins, NUT, and they retained expression of MARC-B1. And Ki-67 was quite high with a mean of 79%. This EMA positivity, as well as the diffuse positivity of synaptophysin and that high Ki-67, made a misdiagnosis of large cell neuroendocrine or small cell even kind of more common than other misdiagnoses. Finally, when they compared these clinical and pathologic features with the SMARCA4 deficient non-small cells, they found that the sarcomatoid tumors were more male, heavier smokers, larger size, 9-centimeter average versus a 3-centimeter average for the non-small cells. They had a much worse prognosis. The TSTs, the sarcomatoid tumors, did not met to the brain. They had a much bulkier peritoneal metastases pattern. They were claudin-4 negative, and most were SMARCA2 deficient, as opposed to the SMARCA deficient non-small cells, where they were claudin-4 positive, SMARCA proficient or retained. It was interesting to note in this context that there was a sharp loss of SMARCA2 as a tumor transitioned from a carcinoma to a sarcoma in those sarcomatoid tumors that did have a focus in non-small cells. So it raises kind of a nosologic connection in that way. The genomic signature, 16 of the sarcomatoid tumors were analyzed by NGS. They had a dominant, what they called a smoking or tobacco signature in 88% of them versus 64% of them in the non-small cell tumors. The control group of conventional sarcomas revealed no smoking signature, and they looked at 44 of those. The SMARCA4 gene alteration was found in 14 of the 16 SDSs, and the SMARCA4 revealed a detectable alterations in 7 of the 16. Tumor mutational burden was comparable in both the sarcomatoids as well as the non-small cells. So their overall argument that these are actually sarcomatoid carcinomas is based on really 5 pieces of data. One, 5 of the 22 sarcomatoid tumors have a non-small cell component in them. Second, there was a focal expression of non-small cell markers. There was some TTF1 and P40 expression in the sarcomatoid tumors that had a non-small cell component. The smoking history with emphysema was found in 21 of the 22 sarcomatoid tumors. And the smoking-related genomic alterations with a dominant smoking signature with and a high TMB correlated more to what the non-small cell clinical picture was. And finally, the metastatic pattern was very similar to what the non-small cell carcinomas had. Again, brain, adrenal, and bone. So overall, I hope this was just a tour de force by Natasha Reckman and her team, a lot of work. The study reveals an abundance of clinical, pathologic, and genomic evidence that supports the theory that these thoracic SMARCA4 deficient sarcomatoid tumors are probably primarily smoking-related, undifferentiated or dedifferentiated carcinomas rather than a primary thoracic sarcoma. Also, SMARCA4 tumors in the thorax, both the sarcomatoid and the non-small cell, can be distinguished from each other just by morphology. Clearly, the sarcoma element is present in the former. And then the IHC is characteristic in that the sarcomatoid tumors were CLDN4 negative and SMARCA2 deficient, while the SMARCA4 deficient non-small cell carcinomas were actually CLDN4 positive and SMARCA2 proficient or retained. Also, despite the widespread involvement of the mediastinum by these big tumors, the authors propose that these probably arise within the lung. And they report that they are now looking at studies in progress that will optimize the clinical management of these tumors. Any questions, comments?
I agree. That is quite a study. They have as many authors as they do cases.
Yeah, it was a lot of work. A number of supplemental tables for those of you who've read it. So a lot of data to weave through, but just an extraordinary study that a place like Memorial can do.
Yeah, no, I think it's a beautiful study of a tumor that we've been dancing around for 25 years.
Right. It reminds me how many of those probably I called a large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. You know, it's a good study that helps clinically as well. Anybody else, any questions or comments? Good. Okay. The third paper is, the next two papers deal with mesothelioma. The first one is by the University of British Columbia group called Use the Programmed Death Ligand 1 or PD-L1 Staining to Separate Sarcomatoid Malignant Mesotheliomas from Benign Mesothelial Reactions. And the background of this is published in the archives. The background of this is separating reactive from malignant mesothelial proliferations is important, but it's, as we know, can be very difficult. The immune checkpoint inhibitors block T cells and macrophages from attacking normal cells as foreign cells. But in normal cells, other than inflammatory cells, the expression of these checkpoint inhibitors is below the limits of detection by antibodies. However, tumor cells can also express these checkpoint inhibitors to block these attacks, but their expression of these antigens is at a detectable level by antibodies. So the purpose of this study was to investigate the use of IHC for checkpoint inhibitor PD-L1 as a method to separate the benign from the malignant mesothelial proliferations. The study design was a retrospective study from the University of British Columbia as well as the Vancouver Coastal Health Archives. The methods were they took tissue microarrays from reactive mesothelial proliferations, epithelioid mesotheliomas, as well as sarcomatoid mesotheliomas. The tissue samples ended up to be 20 tumors on a microarray from epithelial reactive tumors, 20 from spindle cell reactive mesothelial proliferations, 27 epithelial mesos, and 6 sarcomatoid mesos, and that was all part of their microarrays. In addition, they had whole sections where they had 10 reactive spindle cells and 10 malignant spindle cell mesotheliomas. Those were whole sections. Their immunohistochemistry was they used the PD-L1-22C3 DACO antibody done on a DACO machine with antigen retrieval. They looked only at membranous staining and then used a scoring where they looked at cell proportion that they scored from a 0 to 4, staining and intensity that they scored from a 0 to 3. They multiplied those and came up with an accumulated score that was somewhere between 0 and 12. They then separated those into a negative was 0, 1 to 2 was weak, 3 to 8 was moderate, and 9 to 12 was strong. So what did they find? On their PD-L1 scoring, they found in the microarrays that the reactive mesos in both the epithelial as well as the spindle cells were mostly negative or weakly positive. So they were in the 0 to 2 score range. The malignant epithelioid mesos had no statistical staining difference between the reactive mesothelial proliferation. So that turned out to be not helpful. And then the sarcomatoid mesos were highly statistically significant difference between the reactive spindle cell proliferations. So they re-looked at those spindle cells, malignant spindle cell mesos versus reactive spindle cells in the whole sections, and found that the reactive spindle cells were negative in 8 out of 10, and in the malignant spindle cell mesotheliomas, they were overwhelmingly positive, strongly positive. So what's the take-home message on this? Well, PD-L1, at least the 20TC3 DAPO clone, may be helpful in discriminating between reactive spindle cell mesothelial proliferations, the organizing pleuritis, and the sarcomatoid mesotheliomas. It is probably not useful in by this study in distinguishing between the epithelioid mesos and then the reactive mesothelial proliferations. The study is somewhat small. It needs a few higher numbers and needs a, probably a little bit continued fine-tuning of the scoring. In the spindle cell proliferation, it appears that strong staining is diagnostic of a malignant spindle cell mesothelioma or sarcomatoid meso. But the weak pattern in the setting of this reactive spindle cell versus the sarcomatoid meso is not helpful, i.e. this stain does not rule out a mesothelioma in the setting of a negative study. Comments, questions?
Is anybody doing surgery on sarcomatoid mesos, radical resections?
They weren't doing it at the Cleveland Clinic when I left last year, and I've not seen any at the University of Michigan, but Lawrence might be able to say something to that. He's been there longer.
I'm not sure they do them in Boston either. I mean, so that, you know, this is a solution without a problem to me.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not aware of them doing surgeries at the University of Michigan, but I haven't really looked into it, that fully. So,
I'm old-fashioned. I don't like the idea of using an immunostain to make a diagnosis of malignancy, particularly when it would lead to something as radical as an extrapleural pneumonectomy.
Right. I think it's kind of a preliminary study. It's small. I think the biology behind it is interesting, and it may lead to other studies where one uses, PD-L1 as tumor versus non-tumor. But I agree.
What I find most interesting is that the epithelial mesotheliomas didn't really show any significant difference.
I know. That's a good point.
Well, if you don't like
Carol,
if you don't like immunostains for diagnosis, Tom, just wait till the rash of mesothelium in situ papers come out.
Hopefully I'll be dead.
No, they're coming soon.
I'm surprised that Andy didn't compare this, at least, I don't even see a mention of it in the discussion, to other ways of, of other molecular techniques or immunohistochemical techniques, BAP1, NTAP, T16 fish. So I'm just surprised that he doesn't make the comparison here at all to that. There's not even a table. There's really nothing about that in the discussion either, it seems to me. I mean, I just scanned it, but.
Yeah, I mean, the next paper, he deals with MTAP and BAP1, but he doesn't compare it to PD-L1. So,
got it. Thanks.
Yeah. Going on to that next paper, this, again, is another mesothelioma one. This is one that's looking at effusion cytology. This is from the University of British Columbia group as well as from the University of Pittsburgh, and it's usefulness of MTAP and BAP1 immunohistochemistry and diagnosis of malignant mesothelioma in effusion cytology specimens. And again, the background is that the separation of benign and malignant mesothelial proliferations is difficult on effusion cytologies. MTAP, which is located, as we all know, by the CDKN2A gene, has been shown to be frequently deleted in tandem with that gene in patients with malignant mesotheliomas. And MTAP at least in immunohistochemistry, has been established as a fairly good marker of malignancy in mesothelial proliferations in biopsies, but it hasn't been looked at in cytology of fusion specimens. So the purpose of this study by the UBC as well as the Pittsburgh group was to examine the use of IHC for MTAP in differentiating reactive mesothelial proliferations from malignant mesotheliomas in effusion cytology specimens. The loss of BAP1, which is very specific but only moderately sensitive for mesothelioma, was also evaluated in this study as a comparison, which was going to be more sensitive, which was more specific. Again, it's a retrospective study of cohorts that was available of mesothelioma cases that were with a matched positive effusion cytology specimen at UBC as well as the University of Pittsburgh between 2014 and 2018. They came up with 24 cases. 14 of the cases had a corresponding surgical biopsy that was proven to be mesothelioma. 10 of the cases did not have a surgical biopsy correlate, but were classically, by both radiologic and clinical data, consistent with malignant mesothelioma. So those were the positive cases. They also had 15 cases of reactive mesothelial proliferations. And again, the technology was simply they had large amounts of pleural effusion. It was centrifuged. Thin prep slides were made and cell blocks were made. Immunohistochemistry, the MTAP was a clone from AdnovaCore. The scoring was cytoplasmic. It was considered intact if greater than 25% of the cells stained and lost if less than 25% of the cells stained. They also looked at nuclear scoring that turned out to be not helpful or significant, but they scored those as intact if 100% were positive and partial or lost if zero were staining. BAP clone was the Santa Cruz clone. Nuclear staining was intact 100%, partial or lost was 0% staining. They also looked at some FISH for the CDKN2A chromosomal 9 centromeric probe and used that, I think, on the surgical specimens to confirm the presence of that in situ hybridization. So the results were as follows. The MTAP, again, the cytoplasmic staining, three of the cases were excluded up front, so they actually had 21 cases that they looked at through this study. Using the MTAP cytoplasmic staining, 7 of the 21 demonstrated complete loss of MTAP by IHC. 11 of the 21 demonstrated no loss of cytoplasmic staining. 3 had a partial loss, which they ended up lumping into a loss category. Then of the reactive, 15 out of 15 had no loss of MTAP by IHC. So overall, the malignant mesotheliomas by cytoplasmic staining, MTAP was about 33% sensitive, and there was a statistical significant difference between the malignant versus the reactive mesothelium by the cytoplasmic staining for MTAP. The nuclear staining, there was no statistically significant difference. So the BAP one, they had 19 total cases that they looked at, and 13 of the 19 showed loss of nuclear staining consistent with a meso. Again, that sensitivity was 68%. Both MTAP as well as BAP1 had 100% specificity. When you combined the positive cases by MTAP plus the positive cases by BAP1, they had 15 of the 21 malignant mesothelial cytology specimens were found positive. The MTAP diagnosed only one more of those than BAP1 did. And then when you looked at the MTAP compared to the CDKN2A FISH, 5 of the 7 cases paired with a surgical had a positive MTAP when confirmed by the FISH, and 14 of the 14 cases were positive for BAP1 when compared to the FISH. So overall, the MTAP was not as sensitive, 33% versus 68% as BAP1 in distinguishing a reactive versus a malignant mesothelial proliferation by cytology. Their combined sensitivity was about 71%. The specificity of each is 100%, but given this limited sensitivity, again, a failure to detect a loss of either MTAP or BAP1 does not make the process benign, and further workup is needed. That's it. Comments, questions?
Yeah, this is Colby again. There's only 39 cases here. They're dealing with a tumor that within a year and a half you have a pretty good division between those who live and those who die. And they didn't use – there's no clinical follow-up here.
No. No, it is simply an IHC study.
Yeah, but they're making a recommendation as to making a diagnosis of malignancy in a tumor that they would know patients, you know, most of the patients with mesos are going to be dead within a year and a half. I'm just surprised the journal allowed a paper like this to be published without that sort of follow-up. It's easy to get. The cases are from, they go 2014 to 2018.
Yeah. Anything else? Just to end, I have some articles from Notation, which I really thought were good. First of all, the first one is the decalcifying one. It just showed that what we all show, that decalcified decreases the expression of PD-L1, and that EDTA is the gentlest, and the longer it stays in there, the more PD-L1 we lose. And I think that's one that all of us have probably done at our own institutions and know, but it's good to have it in the literature. Then the following ones, again, in that neoplastic category, are kind of interesting variations on a theme of what happens when we look in a more granular way at driver mutations, co-alterations. Can we start to stratify tumors with these different driver mutations in some way, therapeutically or clinically? The non-neoplastic ones I thought were really good. I like the one that they published in the Journal of Heart and Lung Transplantation, looking more at the expanding world of genetic mutations in idiopathic pulmonary arterial hypertension. Clearly, these are rare cases, and now we're getting this expanded platform of genetic mutations that are associated with idiopathic PAH. And it's helping both to clarify in some the diagnosis and in this particular paper the prognosis in these patients. So I see that field kind of pushing forward in the genomic realm very quickly. Also, Anya Rodin did this really great study that I think people in lung transplant have been thinking about doing, and that's looking at ultrastructural changes in biopsies from people who have antibody-mediated rejection, kind of following the kidney pathology people in that realm. And you can read her take-home lessons. And it's she looks at EM, and it showed that there were more specific diagnoses that if you looked at biopsies from AMR patients, it starts to help to define in a more specific way what are the features of AMR versus the kind of diagnosis of exclusion we currently have around acute lung injury, if you rule out infection, et cetera. So I thought it was a nice study, again, a lot of work, and something that I think was the next step toward helping us define more specifically AMR. Finally, there's some interesting, well-illustrated case reports, and then I would just take note of a really nice letter that Lynette Scholl wrote in Histopathology around where we are in PD-L1.
A question on that EM of lung transplant, so that in that study they took a little bit of the biopsy tissue and put it immediately into glutaraldehyde?
Yeah. And
interesting.
I mean, what's nice about this is it opens up this possibility of going back into the archives in these clinically well-adjudicated AMR patients and try to see if we can actually see similar characteristics. And again, it's, you know, I'm not sure how practical it is, unlike the kidney people where they kind of do EM on everything. But it may drive a little bit more specific morphologic features that we're really looking at in AMR in the lung, which is at this point pretty generic, I think. Any other comments or questions?
It's too bad that they didn't. Well, it doesn't seem like they had a control group. So.
Yeah, they actually. I think they did.
That would. I mean, do they address that? Because I mean, really,
yeah,
that's been part of the challenge with lung, you know, AMR is So anyway, I know we're almost out of time, but I just wondered.
They actually did have a control group, Henry. They took ACR as well as non-transplant control biopsies and looked at it. They had.
Okay. Yeah, well, I see it now. Got it.
Yeah. So.
Yep. Thanks.
Anyways, a cool study. Thanks for everyone. Everybody, please stay healthy. Take care of yourselves and everybody around you. And thanks so much for.
Thank you, Carol.
Thanks, Carol.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you.
Bye.